I'm here to tell you as a ham operator, the shortwave frequencies and the radio spectrum have been really weird lately, even after the sun let up taking giant shots at us for a while. It still is very bizarre up there. Dr. Nick Begich, coming up, is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He's well known in Alaska for his own political activities. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Nick received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in November of 1994. He is also the editor of Earth Pulse Flashpoints, a new science fiction book series. Nick has served as an expert witness and speaker before the European Parliament and has spoken on various issues for groups representing citizens' concerns, statesmen, elected officials, scientists, and others. Here from Alaska is Dr. Nick Begich. Doctor, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be with you again, Art. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. And a lot has occurred in between the now and then. And so, you know, I'd like to kind of start from the beginning, Dr. Begich. What does the acronym HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, stand for?
It stands for the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, which is actually a joint effort initially of the Air Force and Navy in Alaska.
Okay. And what is HAARP physically, and what is HAARP supposed to do?
Okay, HAARP is essentially a field or an array of antennas, and what they're designed to create is converting electrical energy into radio frequency energy, and then by utilizing this field of antenna, which presently there are 48 antenna on the ground, and by focusing or firing these antennas in a very specific way, you can focus or concentrate radio frequency energy into a relatively small area in the upper reaches of the atmosphere, in an area above the atmosphere called the ionosphere. And this is a highly charged area, and it's responsible for a great degree with the quality of communications in the country. When solar activity, for instance, happens, this area gets disrupted. Communications also get disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to sort of the roots of HAARP, it's really in the beginning was about looking at the ionosphere and ways to understand it and also ways to control it. And that's where HAARP starts to take on all kinds of dimensions not really looked at in the past. Ideally, from a military's perspective, this instrument on the ground would concentrate radio frequency energy and be able to manipulate that energy in such a way as to change the character of the ionosphere itself, virtually making it part of the machine that is on the ground.
Now, why would anybody want to do this, Doctor?
Well, there's several things that come up in the literature. Firstly, the most obvious from a military perspective is being able to control the ionosphere. For instance, if you could artificially create havoc in the ionosphere in such a way as to deny an adversary, for instance, being able to use any of their wireless communications, and yet because you're operating the system and you understand what you're doing to the ionosphere, you could also carry your own communication signals while denying everyone else theirs. So as a sort of preemptive measure for knocking out an opponent's ability to communicate, that was probably the first fundamental area that military researchers began to look
at. Well, you know, that sounds really military, but my early memories of the explanation for HAARP had nothing to do with the military. The military, well, they were said not to really be involved.
Well, that's going back to let's go back to the companies that began this project, because I think that kind of starts to sort out some of the mystery about this project. It originally started with Atlantic Richfield, which is a large oil and gas company at the time that controlled trillions of cubic feet of natural gas on the North Slope of Alaska. And what they were interested in doing was finding a way to sell that gas or market that gas, and there's no pipeline to bring that gas down from the North Slope into the lower 48 states. So what they were looking for was maybe a way to just use it right where it was. And then arriving on the scene was a gentleman, Dr. Bernard Eastland, who incidentally is a pretty good guy. I've talked to him lots over the years. And he, as a physicist, as a physicist, began to look at this concept and said, you know, if we took that natural gas and we converted it to electrical energy and then we converted that to radio frequency energy, there's some ideas he had about weapons applications that might even create a global shielding effect. But all of that was kind of hidden away, and the things that came out...
So are you saying it was really part of the early Star Wars thinking?
Absolutely. It goes back to the mid-'80s. And even a little bit before, because what happened in the mid-'80s, there was a guy named Ramos, who was one of the founders of TRW, and he was one of the first people that Dr. Eastland went to more or less pitch his concepts of this new weapons technology. And Ramos immediately zeroed in on this global shielding effect. And
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me just for 1 second stop you. I'm trying to imagine how you might take electricity... And, of course, you can convert it to radio frequency, to RF, but then what? I mean, was the idea to transmit it then to another location and reconvert it, or?
Oh, no. Coming straight off of the antenna array, or this field of antennas, by firing them in a specific way, normally, like people listening to us tonight, they're listening via radio, and as that energy comes off of the antenna, it spreads out and gets very, very... less dense very rapidly.
It starts off, of course, as a very narrow signal, AM or FM, and becomes broader and broader as it leaves the antenna. That's the normal way things work. Now,
right.
HARP works the other way around, right?
HARP is much different, because what it does is create what's called a cyclotron resonance, which if you could visualize it, it would look like kind of a corkscrewing motion of energy coming off of this field of 48 antenna. And that would focus the energy or concentrate it to a relatively small area. So it would be by analogy, if you think about what a flashlight does versus what a laser does.
Yes.
The same kind of analogy in this case with radio frequency energy instead of light.
The flashlight broadens out, of course, as we all know. And a laser maintains a very narrow beam. HARP, of course, starts out as a slightly wider beam and becomes very narrow. But again, you're saying this then was envisioned as a way to use these resources, convert them to electricity and then to RF, but always thinking about a shield-type weapon?
Well, that wasn't out in the front of the public initially. Initially, they were talking about things like shunting energy out of the ionosphere for use in powering the electric grid, as an example, because there's tremendous potentials. In fact, when Senator Stevens from Alaska went forward in the floor of the Senate, he talked about this as something right out of Jules Verne, that we'd be able to tap the ionosphere for an endless supply of energy and solve the problems of the world. And, you know, and that was quickly discounted by scientists. And contrary to Stevens' normal behavior, he would have just axed the program. In this case, he didn't. He, in fact, funded the program and continued to fund the program even to this day.
Was that all a facade at the beginning, or was it genuine in the beginning and simply quickly got converted?
Well, I think it was genuine. I mean, Senator Stevens is not someone that makes statements like that without some forethought and without some advice from a lot of very well-informed individuals. So I think initially, as a project, that was something that people were considering. As the military moved into this project, things became much different. And they initially had it all up fronted by the University of Alaska Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks as if it were just an academic exercise. And, you know, that quickly dissipated, and it became clear that those that were really running the show were, in fact, the military when they started utilizing for all public comment a PR guy out of Hascom Air Force Base, who you might remember as John Hexer, someone we tried to get on the air to have a little bit of discussion and open debate on this subject.
Yes. Well, you know, I did have somebody on. Or did I? Maybe that was NASA. No, I guess I never did. I guess we never did get anybody on, did we? We tried.
I think that the issue was they just didn't want to have an open debate, and that was too bad because, you know, we had, at least at one occasion, we had them in a debate in front of our state legislature in Alaska.
I think you and I talked with one of them perhaps on the telephone trying to get them to do it or something along those lines.
It seems to me that we were making a lot of attempts, and what we kept running into was they might consider going on as long as they knew what was coming in advance and that kind of thing, and, you know, that's not the way to talk about these issues. You know, you either have an opinion and some knowledge or you don't. And these guys are on the inside of the program, and either they know their program or they don't. And, you know, the way we looked at it from the very beginning was, you know, in fact, in the very first article I wrote on this subject, because of my family's relationship with the senator, I sent that article in advance to him and his staff through a staff person that had been originally on my father's staff when he was in the Congress, with the idea that if there was some flaw, some fatal flaw in what we were considering, that at least he would have an opportunity to tell me what that was, and I would be more than happy to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only time since my father's disappearance years ago that we never got a response from the senator's office. And it really started to set the stage for what became, for us, a bit of a combat with Stephen's office in terms of how we were approaching this, because we did not intend, and nor do we ever intend, to undermine security. Our issue was that the side effects or the other effects of this device were things that the public really needed to be involved in.
Well, of course, we'll get to all of that. Now, recent headlines. I remember that you originally told us the ultimate goal of HAARP was to actually raise the power levels being used to something like a billion watts.
That's correct.
And I just saw some recent headlines indicating that there had been some funding that had occurred or something or another, and that, in fact, they were in the process of upgrading to, four times the power they're running now or something like that.
Yeah, they're going from 48 antenna to 180, and eventually the goal was 360. And the idea is to create a one gigawatt or 1 billion watts of effective radiated power. And that,
uh-huh.
You know, and the important thing to remember here, and this is where we get into the debate with these guys, they're the ones who publish that information. And then they want to play games with what that means. And so what they've argued with us about is they talk about the input power. And we're not talking about the input power when we're talking effective radiated power. We're talking about the effect of that power at the point in which they're trying to create a reaction, which
that's
is
right.
In the ionosphere.
That's right. This let's explain the difference. Effective radiated power is the totality of the actual power you have with the gain of your antennas.
Right.
So you start off with a certain amount of power, but if you have enough of an antenna, you begin to effectively get more and more and more, and you can continue to double the amount of power. So they can talk about anything they want, but the ERP, or effective radiated power, is really what we have to talk about, because that's reality. That's what's really going to hit the ionosphere.
Right. And this is, you know, this is where the action is. And when you think about the ionosphere, there's some other things that were discovered sort of along the way before HAARP was fully engaged. And one of those things was that if you pump energy into the ionosphere in just the right way at the right frequency, that it actually acts as a catalyst, actually drawing energy or causing energy to be released that's naturally available in any case. In this case, they were using a VLF, a very low frequency signal, and they found out that when it hit the upper reaches of the ionosphere just below the next layer, the magnetosphere, it actually amplified by up to 1,000 times. And that was not energy coming off the ground. It was more like energy, like what would be the equation of the primer on a bullet. You know, it's not the primer that does all of the action. It's the gunpowder that the primer triggers. And the same thing was being discovered, was that you could send energy up in very specific window frequencies and trigger releases of natural energy that was available, causing a much, much greater effect. So you have this huge transmitter on the ground that's very versatile, and then you have the ability then, if you know what these instabilities are, where you can trigger these events, then you have something that's even much, much more powerful and profound in terms of a technology.
Well, so should we not assume, that is the general public, that since this is continuing to be funded and is a very active project, growing indeed and all the rest of it, that there is something to all of this? I mean, they're not going to just, much as our government wastes money from time to time, they're not going to be throwing money at nothing. There is something big going on here.
Absolutely. In fact, if you go back to the early days of all of this debate, back in 1996, the funding for HAARP was under nonproliferation and counterproliferation in the defense budget, because one of the applications, one of the uses, was this idea of what's called earth-penetrating tomography, which in plain language would be like looking into the earth, or by analogy, again, X-raying the earth, or seeing those layers, underground shelters or structures underneath the ground.
But the implication of that is that they get the signal back kind of like radar.
Right, and what they would do is they would send the high-frequency signal up to the ionosphere, but they would pulse that signal. And what would happen is the ionosphere itself would begin to harmonize with that pulse rate. So it acts as like it would convert from DC to an alternating current, and it would actually send a signal back to the Earth in this ELF range, which would penetrate the Earth and then reflect a certain amount of that signal back, which could be analyzed for Earth-penetrating tomography. And on a program called Horizons, which is a BBC program similar to what we have in the U.S. as NOVA, this program, actually they interviewed Papadopoulos at the University of Maryland, one of the principals involved in this particular use, and he said that in after the Congress mandated this demonstration, they actually proved with 99% accuracy that this application would work by looking at underground, known underground mining structures in the area
sure.
of these facilities and being able to deduce what
but
was
But the
possible.
Implication of this is that the RF radio frequency that you send to the ionosphere that then bounces off has got to be strong enough to penetrate the ground, right? And then, and not only penetrate the ground, but then return.
Right. And what we're talking about is It's basically not so much the amount of energy going in, because there are others who have used earth-penetrating tomography, like a gentleman by the name of Brooks Agnew, who actually ran around with a company that all of us know today called Halliburton.
I know, but that's a localized phenomenon. In
right.
other words, they're doing that right there to the ground. We're talking about bouncing off the ionosphere and then hitting the ground.
Right.
And so that's a very, very different kind of thing, because coming back to the ground, you're going to encounter, before you get to the underground bunkers and tunnels or whatever, you're going to get to human beings.
Right. And this is problematic, because the ELF range is in fact the same range of frequency that our brains operate on. And what we have learned about the brain is it's not so much the intensity of the signal as it is the frequency of the signal that can
right.
cause dramatic and different effects that are basically, I won't say unexpected, because many in the scientific community now understand what's happening, but certainly in the classical training that many scientists get in the life sciences, it's sort of out of the context of what they're used to seeing. And I think that's the difference between the physicist and the life scientist, if you will. They look at things much, much differently.
Theoretically, what kind of effect on the brain and then consequently human behavior might there be?
Well, it's not even theory anymore. It's a fact. Actually, at Yale University, what was discovered by a gentleman by the name of Jose Delgado in the mid-80s, he used radio frequency energy at 1/50th of what the Earth naturally creates, and was able to influence the behavior of humans and primates, from changing them from lethargic and passive to highly aggressive, almost like flipping on and off a light switch. And that was done with no physical contact, no implants, nothing, just RF in the right frequency range. That is pretty dramatic. And let's put that in perspective. The Earth naturally creates an amount of RF. This is at 1/50th. What's around us right now at this moment is about 200 million times what the Earth creates, just by what man creates.
Wow.
And yet, in a coherent signal within the right frequency range, you can trigger this kind of cascading effect in terms of brain chemistry, causing huge, huge changes.
Would the implication there be that what the Earth emits normally affects our behavior? Hence, if the radiation from the Earth were to in some way change, our behavior would change with it. Would that be?
Well, not necessarily, because the Earth, the energy coming off of the Earth is not necessarily a coherent signal. It's more random and scattered across the a range of the spectrum. We're talking about a man-made signal that maintains a pulse rate for a specific period of time to allow those reactions to occur, something that nature normally doesn't do. A good example of this, and to take it on a different scale, you know, people think about a television set as being pretty harmless. You know, you sit back 10 feet from the TV and you're watching the television, and the light emitting from the TV is very low density by the time you're 10 feet away. I mean, there's not much energy striking you.
Right.
Yet, if you remember back in Japan a few years back, around 97, there was this episode where these kids were watching a cartoon and 700 of them went to the hospital with epileptic seizures.
That's right.
And it wasn't the amount of energy. It was just the pulse rate of the coherent signal that was coming off the TV that was maintained for just enough time, that flicker rate.
To set them off.
To set them off.
Dr. Bigage, would it be possible to take a very active, very aggressive, even military person and have them become lethargic?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's, you know, when you look at what's happening in terms of military science right now, this is one of the big initiatives. It's not just about HAARP. HAARP is just one of many, many systems being developed that essentially utilize energy for a number of weapons applications, including debilitating troops in the field by using energy as the base rather than bullets and bombs.
Or even potentially set up a state where the person's nearly frightened to death.
Absolutely.
So these are incredible possible applications, incredible. And as I mentioned, it's now being, the temperature is going up, so to speak, and they're really cranking it up there. What might we expect from this next level of energy that they're about to go to?
Well, you know, this is the area where we start to all speculate, including the scientists that are involved, and their sort of take on it is it's their plasma lab in the sky, you know, and that's actually they have said that, you know, looking at this experiment, and the objective for them is to find that next level of stability after creating an unstable situation.
Translation, then, they don't know what...
They do not know.
They don't know.
But here's, you know, when you get back to this idea of influencing behavior, you know, we took this issue up with the European Parliament several years ago, and as part of that, we took in the same concept of manipulating behavior, and as part of the resolution that eventually passed the European Parliament, they dealt with three sections dealt with HAARP, and then the fourth section of our area of that resolution dealt with this idea of manipulating human behavior. And I'll just read the one sentence because it's really revealing. And it says, it calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings, unquote.
Huh.
Now, to get a legislative body, a political body, to put that in print, you have to demonstrate an awful lot. And in that case, we did. We demonstrated the technology as well as provide the data that supported it. And this was unclassified data, material in the public domain, that convinced the European Parliament that this was possible and that this was possible with HAARP. Now, since then, in 2002, back in August of 2002, the Russian Duma, their parliament or their legislature, passed a resolution in opposition to HAARP for all of the straight military applications and this specific application, the influencing of behavior over large geographic areas. And this is more or less could be used for changing the emotional state, for instance, of combatants, making them fearful or anxious as opposed to confident and ready to fight.
Well, of course, we just had, and actually we're still having, an open conflict with Iraq. Do you think that any of this technology, is there any sign at all that HAARP became particularly active during the recent Iraq war?
Well, if we go back to Afghanistan, right after the 9/11 event, in November 27th of 2001, there was an MSNBC story suggesting that HAARP be used in Afghanistan or a system like HAARP for locating underground facilities. And nothing ever was heard after that. I mean, the story ran and then it went away.
Oh, no, I understand. But I know that you monitor, to some degree, the activity of HAARP and get reports on it. Is there any activity that during that, any period of time since or during the war, it became more active?
Well, you know, the thing that's happened with HAARP is they're not announcing much these days, but there were what they call engineering tests during some of these periods of time. And the problem is now sorting it out, which is an engineering test that's legitimate,
yes,
and which is just a way to hide what they're doing.
Yes.
The problem with so much of this is without independent monitoring, and that takes, you know, some equipment and some time and commitment, you know, there's not a whole lot that you can really deduce without that independent monitoring. The countries that are most apt and able would be the former Soviet Union, now Russia, because they had developed a certain level of technology. In fact, the predecessors to HAARP were Russian ionospheric heaters, which is what we used to call these things. And when you go back to the old Russian literature and you look at what was happening, you know, all the way up until the 1990s, the early 90s, they were still proposing. In fact, they were proposing to us a joint effort on missile shields, utilizing this exact same technology, and we refused. And then we come back around almost a decade later, offering them the same opportunity, and they refuse, leveraging their arguments for foreign aid and money and so forth, which, of course, is the nature of the way things work.
Okay, I have a question for you, related but not right on the mark. I'm a ham operator. In the last several months, a couple of months anyway, we've been noticing this incredible noise on the 40-meter band, this pulsing 100 kilohertz wide noise on the 40-meter band that comes and would come and go and come and go. And I got so upset about it, as did several of my friends, that I actually recorded it, or a friend of mine did, Jim, and I played it on the air. And for a couple of nights, I played it on the air. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, it disappeared for several weeks. It just went away after I did that.
Interesting.
And the question is this. Now, originally, I know you remember the Russian, we called it affectionately, the Russian woodpecker.
Right.
That was that a form of ionospheric heater?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Those were the early versions, and there were five of them in the former Soviet Union, and they're the ones that created that signal. And what we need to remember is HARP is not the only transmitter like this on the planet today.
Well, my question continues. Let me finish it up. And so we thought, aha, this new noise probably is some sort of over-the-horizon radar, but gee, we don't need that anymore because we've got satellites, and the Russians have satellites, the Chinese have satellites, and that sort of replaced the need for over-the-horizon radar, looking for missiles that would be in the launch phase, that sort of thing. You could understand it. Once it got satellites, we wouldn't need it. Question is, are other third world nations now beginning to experiment with this because they don't have satellites up there, but they'd still like to be able to look over the horizon? So Is there experimentation going on in certain countries around the world?
Well, there's indications the answer is yes. I mean, in Canada right now, they have constructed a number of these facilities, not because of their lack of economy to support satellite technology, just because they have put these in conjunction with HARP. In fact, Rosalie Bertel, who's a Canadian researcher, she's a physicist and an MD. She was a lead physician on the Bhopal incident, as an example, very, very well-respected scientist. She actually published material in Great Britain on what was happening in Canada with their ionospheric heaters. And then if you look at what's going on in Europe, the ISICAT system is advancing. In fact, the Norwegians, their parliament has started to discuss this issue. We've gotten called in the last few months by media from that location. So there are other transmitters operating that may be responsible for this signal. The other consideration is third world development or proliferation of this technology. The thing about it is, it's when you get right down to it, and when I've had engineers look at the contracting documents, which are public records, there's nothing hidden about them, their reaction was, you know, the thing is pretty simple. In the idea, it's really developing the computer software to drive it, but that kind of technology is pretty flat. There's nothing here that you couldn't get literally off the shelf and recombine it to form a transmitter like this.
What do you think they're really trying to do right now? In other words, are they still in the tunnel and bunker phase? Are they in the effect on humans phase? Are they trying to knock ICBMs out of out of their trajectory? What are they bearing down on right now? What's our best guess?
Missile defense is the big issue right now. At least that's what's masking a lot of the funding. You know, missile defense, we said early on back, in fact, it was 8 years ago that we went on with you, in fact, 8 years ago this month, and we said that this was a ground-based Star Wars system then, and we suggested in the course of all of our work that this would eventually lead to a new weapons system for missile defense. And in fact, if everyone has followed the news, we know that, you know, the ABM treaty has been abandoned by the United States, and we're building a missile defense system in Alaska, originally projected to cost $11 billion and then projected to be $65 billion, and now we're hearing numbers in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And what we're hearing about are special systems for detecting these incoming objects, which I believe a lot of that material and a lot of that research was done on the basis of what happened at HARP. The other thing that we're hearing in the open literature is this story about silos. In fact, they're building the silos for the missiles to intercept missiles. I do not believe for a moment that that is going to be an effective system, and neither do most scientists that have been out there and looked at it for a variety of reasons. You know, they've had a number of tests, and about half of them have failed.
Right.
And these are under ideal conditions. And you have to consider how fast you know, an intercontinental ballistic missile at its optimum speed re-entering is going to maybe get 30,000 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah. I heard a rumor, Doctor, that there was some hanky-panky going on with the testing in the sense that some of the test vehicles that were to be destroyed were transmitting some sort of signal that would enable the interceptor to home right in.
Right, and you know that one of the key scientists on that project quit.
Did you hear about that?
I've heard that story, but I haven't seen the documents. What I have seen
story.
Is the comments of the scientists that about a year or two ago quit because she said that they were manipulating the results to get positive results for the Congress. If you think about that, you know, what is most likely, in my view, where I think this is headed is not to missiles intercepting missiles, but electromagnetic weapon systems being used to do that. In fact, there's a United States patent by the Department of Energy from 1990, now 13 years old. It's patent number 4959559, and it would create a much different kind of discharge. It wouldn't be a missile leaving. It would be a ball of lightning leaving the discharge point that would travel at approximately 186,000 miles a second.
Huh.
Okay, so just to put that in perspective, you can go around the Earth seven times in less than a second at that speed. So this is tremendous velocities. Now you take a look at that concept, and you talk about energy weapons intercepting something with a great deal of precision, you've got a much different equation. With HARP, what they showed is you could not only get this over-the-horizon effect to detect objects, but using special satellite-based technologies, using gamma-ray detectors in conjunction with HARP, you could actually sort out which of those incoming objects would carry were carrying nuclear payloads.
The real McCoy from the decoys.
That's right. And this is something that scientists who have been opposing the missile defense system...
That's an awful lot of detail, Doctor.
Oh, yeah. But they've been saying that you can't do this. Well, in fact, you can. And the next thing you can do is you can increase the power, and this is what we can look forward to in the next phase of HARP, is to be able to increase the power sufficiently to disrupt the controls of those objects coming in. In other words, to disrupt their computer by what's called an EMP or an electromagnetic pulse, a surge of energy that overrides those circuits. The thing about it is HARP isn't a precision kind of weapon where you can target like one object. You're going to hit the whole mass of everything within that area, including civilian planes and so on, which, you know, in a nuclear attack, I mean, the military has to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
Those are some of the tough decisions that someone one day may have to make.
I wonder how you test something like that.
Now, that's the real question. And how do you test a ball of lightning? And yet, think about some of the reports that you and I both have heard over the years coming out of primarily Australia, where they have these visual images of these balls of energy that seem to be traveling at tremendous velocities, almost too fast to even track.
I've seen them myself.
Not
in person, but I've seen videotape of them from space.
That's right.
And they're like balls, shots of plasma that just rise at an unbelievable rate.
Yep, and this is exactly what the Department of Energy had patented all those years ago, and most likely more in line with what we're going to see in real missile defense. But now put that concept on top of this concept that the president has introduced, which is preemptive warfare. In other words, you can establish a weapon system that can fire off so many rounds so rapidly, you could basically bring down the infrastructure of a small country before they even had an opportunity to know they were being attacked.
Huh.
That's a startling shift. And when you think about some of the initiatives happening internationally with other countries right now in space, it starts to open the door to a whole lot of questions. It's not about a trip to the moon, folks.
Right.
It's about technical capability, because ultimately warfare and the war fighting platforms are going to move into space more so than they already have.
Do you have any indication how far along they are with such a weapon?
You know, given that it's a 13-year-old patent, I would say it's probably in the pretty advanced development stage. And when you think about what's in the public literature is usually just the tip of the iceberg, including the patent record, because normally many of these kinds of patents never even make it into the public record.
Well, I know this. If we were hit by an electromagnetic pulse of sufficient size, the United States economy would be completely decimated. We have come to the point with computers and so many records being kept by computers that anything that would literally wipe everything out would stop the United States cold.
Absolutely. In fact, on a small scale, you know, they've used these for police departments and experiments to knock out the electronic ignitions of cars. You know, but you can scale that up to something that's hitting a whole hemisphere. You know, and that's what you're talking about when you're talking about HAARP technology and the capabilities that go with it.
Would such a weapon of necessity have to be robotic? Wouldn't it be so dangerous for the people who, for lack of a better phrase, pulled the trigger? Wouldn't it get them?
Well, they set up HAARP with one of the requirements in the contract was fiber optics for controlling it, so that you could control it remotely.
Oh, so they don't sit at HAARP and run it; they remotely operate it.
If they choose to, absolutely. Especially where they have you're talking about the energy in the side lobes and energy that's going to hit
absolutely
people on the ground.
Just in the general area. Sure.
Yep, and this is how they avoid that. They basically any of the high energy tests would be done remotely, so they're out of the field of harm. At least
what are HAARP's favorite frequencies? What range do they operate in, Doctor?
You've got me where I'm not sitting with documents that I can refer to, but it's essentially a high frequency signal. But I can tell you this is the primary range is only one component, because what showed up in the literature is that it affects potentially either primarily or secondarily, depending on the effects you create. It covers 16 decades of the spectrum, which goes from ultra low to visible light. They can trigger everything within that range by just manipulating the signal on the ground.
I recall you telling me about a harmonic relationship that they would start, or they would modulate with some sort of extremely low frequency signal, and then another low frequency signal, and then there'd be the sum and the difference of those two that would produce some outrageous cascading effect.
Okay, this is actually where they send the VLF energy up into the upper reaches of the ionosphere. And what they know happens at that point is the way it couples, it actually releases energy of 1,000 times more power to the energy that was just delivered. The same equation, a good analogy would be like if I put dominoes from here to Paris and I increase their size, say 1% with each domino. But I hit the first one with just a flick of the finger. You know, by the time they hit, Paris, there's one the size of the Eiffel Tower crushing it. Now, it wasn't my flick of the finger that did that any more than it was the HAARP signal hitting the ionosphere. It was the release, in this case, of the dominoes, gravitational energy that was already available. In the case of the ionosphere, it's releasing energy that's already there, energy generated from the sun interacting with our magnetic field lines. and that's what they're triggering. So you're talking about being able to hit those specific window frequencies.
So hopefully you've got an idea of what it is that HAARP is. It's this high energy radio frequency blast that's sent up to the ionosphere for various stated goals and reasons. And one of the possibilities that we just asked about prior to the top of the hour was affecting our weather, to which Dr. Begich said, absolutely. I would love to understand, or even try to understand, the dynamics between high-frequency RF to the ionosphere and some or any effect on the weather. How would that, or how might that occur, Doctor?
Okay, looking at just the mechanical idea of heating the ionosphere, and what happens in that heating is interesting. Is you, above HAARP, as it's currently configured, you can heat an area about 30 miles in diameter.
Huh.
And you can lift that area. By heating it, it pushes it further out. And so you push out what would look like a column going out maybe as far as an additional 200 kilometers. So you're talking about changing the local atmospheric conditions, because when you push this hole, the lower atmosphere moves in to fill that space.
Hmm.
And what that does is it alters the local pressure systems, and it also alters jet stream flow. So just as a mechanical activity. Now, whether or not you can trigger other things with electrostatics or using the electricity or the electrical radio frequency energy itself and triggering things, there's some question about that, because Russians have been doing this work for years. In fact, in the last 2 weeks, I was called by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that was interviewing me for an article on weather modification taking place in South Texas, where they brought in a bunch of Russian specialists using, I believe they're using electrostatics. That's what they have announced.
Is that so?
Yeah.
The Russians made, as you know, all kinds of interesting claims, like being able to create cyclones,
right,
to put out fires in Southeast Asia and all this baloney. And I was wondering, and you're saying there's electrostatic technology behind it?
Yes, and that's according to the articles that came out in the late 1990s on the subject.
Really?
But again, looking at this sort of mechanical way of heating the ionosphere and lifting it, there was an issue of Scientific American that was published, I believe it was in May of 2000. It might have been May 2002. But you can tell because the whole issue is dedicated to weather. And about midway through is a map of Alaska, and it shows the jet stream traveling through south central Alaska. And at one point, it takes a dog leg north about 50 miles, then goes east about 75, and then south about 50 miles, then travels on its way.
Mm-hmm.
It coincidentally, and I say coincidentally because there was no independent monitoring of HAARP, this dog leg occurred right above the HAARP facility.
Well, son of a gun.
And here's what it did. It moved weather fronts out of East Texas and Louisiana into central Florida and dropped a couple of tornadoes right in the city of Orlando a few years back.
There you are. In other words, the jet stream, I'm sure on your local stations, folks, you've seen your weatherman depict the jet stream, and it's kind of like a big, long snake, and it curls around frequently, dips way down south, cuts up across a lot of times right where I am here in Nevada, and then north across the country, and then starts dipping down again when it gets to the East Coast. And it, you know, it shifts and moves around. And wherever the jet stream is, there's always weather action going on right below it, it seems like. And so if you were to change this snake way up north, then it would whip around down south, wouldn't it, Doctor?
That's right. And the thing about this is again, it's unpredictable in terms of what it really does, because we're not capable of modeling the entire system and understanding all of the intricacies of how it works. One of the things I pointed out to the reporter from Texas that was interviewing me, she goes, well, this is really a good thing. You know, we're going to get rain in an area we haven't had. And I said, okay, well, you tell me when 1,000 communities do this all over the world and it disrupts the weather for everyone else on the planet and maybe denies rainfall where it otherwise would go, how would we feel if all of a sudden, say, the country of Canada decided to increase its rainfall and it ended up depriving the rest of the lower 48 United States of its normal precipitation, causing our crops to fail? How would we feel about that? Well, we would consider that an aggressive act. In fact, it would actually violate an international treaty signed by the United States in 1978, when it was ratified, which was a treaty that said we would not modify the weather except for peaceful purposes. Now, that gets a little squirrely because
what's a peaceful purpose? Well, to us it might be lots of rain in Oklahoma or, I don't know, in Kansas where they need some rain or something. But from the Canadian point of view, it wouldn't be peaceful at all.
Right, and that's exactly right. And now the other point that comes up is Eastland actually did more work in the weather modification area. He actually had a contract from the European Space Agency that turned into a peer-reviewed paper that would utilize HAARP-type instruments for knocking out the energy contained or redistributing the energy contained in tornadoes. And here's the way he envisioned that working. He would use the ionospheric heater to actually, you know, when tornadoes form, it's a cold front hitting a warm front, and it creates a shearing action that causes that twisting to begin. And
yes,
so
sir.
The more extreme the difference in temperatures and so on, and just a whole lot of factors, you can actually see that go from, say, a 2 to a 4, depending on, you know, what that energy exchange is looking like.
Yes.
Now, if you could heat up the part that was cold to keep that shearing action from happening in the first place, maybe you could stop that tornado from forming. In fact, you would stop it.
Or conversely.
Or just the opposite. What if you miss or miscalculate and you heat up the already area that's warmed,
yes,
creating a greater difference and a more extreme reaction instead of getting a class 1, maybe you get a class 4 tornado out of it. Now, that wasn't lost on the United States when that work was done for the European Space Agency, and Bernard actually got a contract with FEMA, interestingly enough, and NASA to demonstrate or at least to analyze the possibility of doing the same thing using space-based lasers, for instance, to create the heating effect. And that work was actually completed as well. The point is, what's happening, and this has been raised with the last three secretaries of defense, this discussion about even abandoning this old treaty on the basis that the technology now is becoming so desirable from a military perspective that they'd like to advance it.
And well, while I would like to believe, Doctor, that we adhere scrupulously to every treaty that we put our John Hancock to, I don't believe that for a second. So what are the odds that we are now doing this kind of experimentation under the name of something else?
Absolutely. I would say 100%.
100%. Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah, and the reason I would say that is because when you read the treaty, and I reread the treaty in the last couple of months, there are so many holes in that treaty you could drive a truck through it. The fact is, all you have to do is make the assertion that it's for peaceful purposes, and largely you could escape the treaty guidelines. And it even speaks about ionospheric modification as a specific area within that treaty, and this is exactly the stuff of HAARP.
Have you lately seen maps of the world showing the ice shrinkage both at the North Pole and the South Pole?
Yes, I have. In fact, it's something that I followed for a number of years because in my region of the world, of course, we see the effects of it much more rapidly. You know, when this idea of global warming is amplified at the poles, the fact of the matter is, in my lifetime, I can take you to glaciers that once I could see from roads that now are so far back in the mountains you can't see them. You can look at pictures of glaciers 100 years ago versus today and see huge, huge differences. In the area of Valdez, they're almost 800 feet thinner than they were at the turn of the century when the last gold rush was going.
Well, you know, there are people who argue, perhaps with some merit, that these things are cyclic. Perhaps so, but when you look now at the North Pole, for example, and it looks like two-thirds of what once was ice and solid snow and ice or whatever was up there is gone now. Two-thirds of it are gone, and there will soon be a new ocean at the Arctic, one that we're now going to have to navigate for military purposes and learn to patrol and all the rest of it. I mean, things are changing so quickly from a weather point of view that one really might imagine they are, by gosh, they're trying something.
Well, I think there's a combination of factors. You know, I don't disagree with the natural cycles, because looking at the geologic record, you can see that. But now what you're doing is, at a time when already you're seeing dramatic changes, we're adding in tremendous amounts of coherent, controlled energy to trigger further instabilities. That is a reckless approach from my perspective and many others around the planet today.
Well, we're short little mortal beings, Doctor. We're not here very long, and I always thought we're not supposed to see those kinds of changes within our short mortal life, that these changes should occur over tens or hundreds of thousands of years, not from 1985 through 1991 and that sort of thing. Those small periods, tiny periods of time from a geologic perspective, we're getting these giant changes.
That's right. And you know, and what I would say is we haven't seen anything yet. And I mean that sincerely, because
really?
I believe we're going to see an acceleration of these shifts in chaotic conditions, both from nature and from man's activities, particularly when man begins to utilize systems specifically designed to interfere with these natural processes. And that is what we're in the process of seeing happen.
20, 25 years ago, it was unthinkable that they'd call off the Iditarod race because it wouldn't be enough snow.
Right.
It was just unthinkable.
Well, and you know, we've got a problem in my part of the world. I mean, this year is the first year this looks like winter in quite a while in my part of Alaska. And, you know, we've seen huge changes. And, you know, that last winter, we didn't even have snow till December 11th in South Central Alaska. You know, that is unheard of. You know, when I grew up in Alaska as a young kid, by October, we always had snow on the ground because we went out. You know, that was trick or treating, right? And it was always a mess because you had to fight the snow and the cold. Nowadays, it's not so much that way. In fact, we have a week on the front end and a week on the back end, more time in the summer than we used to have.
And do you know there's an Air Force website that boasts that by 20-something or another, they'll own the weather?
Yes. Actually, we cite that that study in the book Earth Rising the Revolution, which we published in 2000.
What do they mean they'll own the weather?
The idea is they want to control a number of specific factors. In fact, what they were talking about was controlling it for the battle space. In other words, if you could control the weather, think about that in terms of its implications. And one of the other considerations is controlling the weather, you could actually fight a war without ever declaring it or without ever being upfront about it. In other words, you could have a clandestine war that denied someone the benefits of a proper weather distribution, perhaps causing massive droughts such as what we see in North Korea today. You know, that kind of phenomena can be artificially created with the right technologies that are available today. When you look at of that particular owning the weather as a concept, there's a number of papers that speak to that. And you can go back into the early days of the discussion, which in the hearing before the Subcommittee on International Organizations, which was a committee on international relations in the House of Representatives on July 29, 1975, was a prohibition on weather modification as a weapon of war. It was a resolution number 28, passed at that time. And what they said, and this is interesting, is that if weather modification research is open and above board, if it is conducted domestically by domestic agencies, then a fairly high level of credibility can be established. If, on the other hand, weather modification research is conducted in secret, frequently outside the country by military or intelligence agencies, then I would suggest that any treaty would not be worth the paper it was printed on, unquote. And that was by a congressman in the committee in 75, and I would say he's right. It's not worth the paper it's printed on because weather doesn't respect international boundaries that are artificially drawn by mankind.
Well, or we could think of it this way. There's not really any point in making treaties against doing something that can't be done.
Right, and this is... Think how old that is, 1978. And you know when the dialogue started? Because it takes time, you know, to get to the finish line on these things.
Yes.
It was 72 when the conversations first began. That's how far back this technology goes. And it wasn't just about weather. It was environmental manipulation. They were considering things within that treaty such as stimulation of earthquakes or volcanic eruptions or tidal waves, those kind of geophysical phenomena that didn't come back around until April 1997 when Secretary of Defense William Cohen was lecturing with Senators Lugar and Nunn at a conference on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction in U.S. strategy. That was April 28, 1997. And he said in the press briefing afterwards, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely, through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. Think about that from a seated Secretary of Defense at the time making that assertion about terrorist states.
Well, all of this sounds really Tesla-like to me.
You know, it's interesting because when you go back to Dr. Eastland's original work, you know, he actually references a number of articles from Tesla's early experiments going back even to 1915 and then his later ideas in the early 40s, just before his death. And, you know, Tesla, you know, had this concept, and when you really look at all of his patents, they were about oscillating energy, about modulating energy.
That's right.
Specific ways to create resonance effects. And resonance effects are easily understood if you think about dialing through the radio station, as people did tonight to get into this program. In between the stations is just static, but when you have resonance between the transmitter and the receiver, you have a nice clear signal. The same is true in the human body. The same is true in the earth. The same is true in every physical thing. You can create resonance effects that have devastating capability.
Were there not rumors that Tesla at some point had shaken a building, had caused an earthquake, all kinds of interesting rumors in that area about Tesla?
Yeah, actually, it was based on a technology that he had developed. That rumor was based on an experiment in New York City in 1898, where he took a small oscillator, attached it to an I-beam in an office building.
That was it.
And then that I-beam that was, you know, then deep into the earth, it was just a small oscillator that created an oscillation in harmony with the earth at that particular point, causing that resonance effect, and it supposedly broke glass for several, in buildings surrounding this event. Now, I never saw anything that confirms that. I keep seeing it in the literature, But this, again, is the kind of thing that speaks to exactly what Secretary of Defense Cohen was saying 100 years later.
Exactly.
And here we are revisiting the same game all over again, and we're saying that it's so simple that even a terrorist can figure it out. That is a telling tale when you think about what is possible today. And when you look at these kinds of weapon systems being developed, they also all create a very clear signal. Anyone who's experimenting in this area would understand what the dynamics of those signals are, and those can be easily monitored by satellite-based technology. So we probably have a pretty good idea of where these technologies are being tested and played with. And yet, you know, we're the biggest player probably on the block, so we're not saying a whole lot.
Well, we went in and confiscated all of Tesla's research and all of his materials and everything, and frankly, a lot of what we're doing right now sounds like it's the same rough idea. In other words, tickling the tail of the tiger, you know, for the giant effect, whether it's HAARP or whether it's research into weather control or weapons that would act as a shield for the whole country. Right. All of this sounds like it's tickling the tiger's tail, doesn't it?
In fact, I think it really is. I think when you look at this whole situation, it's the technologies have now caught up in many respects to what Tesla had envisioned, because many of the ideas he had, you know, he would actually have to create all of the things that were necessary to make it happen.
Hold on, doctor. The people understand what we're talking about here by, you know, tickling the tiger's tail. Doctor, was I right? I mean, in the old days, you could do scientific experiments that perhaps would have some sort of local effect, possibly a negative effect or a positive effect, who knows, but local. These days, we're beginning to experiment with tickling the tail of the tiger, of the global tiger.
Absolutely, and HAARP is not the only example of it. There are several systems being developed and that have created some level of controversy that are essentially doing the same thing in different areas. The underwater sonars are a good example of, you know, of what's happening in the seas. In the same vein, is, you know, when you're looking at these kinds of systems, they're not like of the past where we looked at, you know, doing these events that were localized. I mean, we could, you know, using ordnance bombs and bullets, you know, certain things happened, but they didn't have global implications in the manner in which they do now. Now we're talking about deliberately manipulating a normal environmental systems as if they were a component to plug into a machine on the ground. That is the difference.
Yeah, and the other thing is that science has had a habit, always, actually, of sort of, it's not quite this bad, but, gee, let's push this button and see what happens, you know? And so there is some of that, because a lot of times they honestly, and they will even tell you, they don't know what's going to happen when they push that button. Not exactly. Certainly we all know when they tested the A-bomb, there was a significant percentage of people who thought it would set off a chain reaction in the atmosphere and burn up the whole damn atmosphere.
Right. In fact, you know, the scientists, a part of the way our science is developed in the United States, we compartmentalize most of our military research. And what that means is we separate all of the various specialties in the sciences, and they each kind of work on their own little piece of the puzzle.
Sure.
And only a few people know how the puzzle goes together at the top. So one group of specialists doesn't really understand necessarily the implications of their science for other areas of science. So, you know, often they'll say, yeah, you know, but I never heard about that. I mean, I hear that from science all the time. Well, I never heard about that, as if they had heard everything that ever was uttered on the planet.
That's right. All right. Now, very quickly, with regard again to HAARP, HAARP is now owned by a company that has something to do with DARPA. What's DARPA?
DARPA is the it is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Is that what it is? Okay.
That's who they are. And actually, you know, they are the ones that have the funding for the next couple of years to take this array to the next step.
Ah, so DARPA's funding the new money, huh?
That's where the new money is. Now, DARPA didn't miss HAARP along the way. Back in 1997, they had actually published a little blip about HAARP in a topic number DARPA 97-088. Where they talk about using HAARP and High Pass, which is the other facility located at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, specifically for subsurface monitoring, for looking at what's under the ground.
Mm.
So DARPA's had an interest in HAARP, but this is the first time that we've seen them take basically take control of the funding, which means, you know, those who control the gold control the destiny, you know, in terms of how this project is going to go.
Yes.
So with DARPA engaged, and this idea of earth-penetrating tomography going back to 1997, one of their principal issues, you can still see the merit of that. I mean, today, look at the situation in Iraq. If we could get full imaging under the ground, wouldn't that be useful? Which is exactly what John Heckscher said to us in 1994 when we were researching this subject in the early days. He said, wouldn't this be great? Because it was in the aftermath of the first Gulf War. Well, here we are a decade later asking the same question.
Doctor, do you get people coming to you who know what's going on in the inside right now? I mean, frankly, they could be so far along, we don't even have a clue how far along they are. Do you ever have people, you know, sort of, I'll tell you type guys come to you and tell you what's going on?
You know, I've had only a couple of occasions, and generally I won't reference those sources because I won't reference an anonymous source.
Of course.
And it, to me, that's just not a valid way. However, there have been occasions where we've been pointed in some directions to go look, to go ask for the right things.
Yes.
That they have to give us because they're public records. So in that sense, yes. There's also a couple of people that we've been communicating with recently that are compiling some things from the inside of this program that are non-classified materials. Because we will not touch anything that's classified. It's just we don't need it. We don't want to go there, and I don't want to go to jail. Quite
well,
frankly.
You're always getting close to it.
Oh yeah, we're on the edge.
Have you ever been offered?
Yes.
Oh,
and we've declined.
And you've declined.
Yep, and we've declined because we don't know whether we're being set up for the fall.
Yes.
Or whether it's something that we really need. And our position on it is, as long as the national security rules are as they are, we'll respect the law. Mm-hmm. And our position is the law ought to be changed. And when that law changes and we have the ability to at least conceptually debate these issues and that those issues, concepts become disclosed, then it would be another matter. But our view is, we may not agree with the way it works, but we'll respect the law as it currently stands and work with the public literature.
Fair enough. All right, a couple of other things I want to touch on. You've written something about China. You know, China is going to the moon. They say they're going to the moon, and it's a curious thing indeed because, of course, we've been to the moon, and from what I was told, nothing but a bunch of rocks and no real reason to go there, and yet, as a matter of fact, I understand our own president may be about to announce as early as Monday, it could happen, that we're going back to the moon. He's going to go back to the moon with a shuttle. China's announced they're going to the moon. What's going on here?
Well, It's not really so much about the moon as it is about developing technologies for what are considered would be used as low orbiting space platforms. And the idea is to gain enough knowledge so that we can put in space platforms that could maintain relatively low orbits. We have figured out ways to stabilize satellites now.
Well, how does going to the moon help that?
Well, you know, because you got to have the basic technology. I mean, you have to be able, and at the same time, when you're developing, you know, China to go out to the world and announce, hey, we're going to develop space-based platforms, that's not going to be a very popular concept.
Probably not.
On the other hand, a trip to the moon doesn't really bother everybody as much as military applications,
oh.
But ultimately they result in the same basic knowledge.
I see.
How to develop the technology. Remember the part of this was going back, I think, to the tether experiment. Do you remember that one?
Clearly.
Okay. You know, one of the big problems with maintaining low orbits is the power source. And one of the things with HARP early on was that you could actually concentrate the energy in such a way that it could be converted then by space platforms orbiting at low orbits, so you could keep it aloft for an indefinite period of time without refueling. The tether experiment, in my opinion, was not just about sticking something down there to drag through the ionosphere. It was about sucking energy off the ionosphere by moving through that area.
Yes.
And the energy that they conducted off of it was significantly more than anybody expected. It almost destroyed the shuttle, as many will recall.
It sure did. It burned the hell out of that tether, just like that.
Yep. But take that concept now and consider the fact that If you could draw that energy off in a controlled way, now you're talking about some serious
energy.
Serious energy.
You know, this is perhaps related or unrelated. Actually, I think it's related, Doctor. As a ham operator, I now have up this incredible antenna. I put up this two-wire, 1,000-foot loop And I put a grounding system all the way under it, you know, a welded wire mesh wire, 4 feet wide all the way under it. And the loop itself's up at fed at 100 feet, and then it's 75 feet and 68 feet all the way around an acre and a quarter I have here. And I began getting almost 400 volts on a clear, cloudless, windless day off that antenna. So bad that I had to come up with a device to ground the voltage so that it wouldn't damage my equipment. Now, where the hell was that coming from? It had AC and DC components to it. I'm going to experiment more with it. As a matter of fact,
free energy.
By the way, Doctor, I just acquired some property, and I'm going to double the size of my loop. It's going to be going soon around 5 acres in another month or so. Big project ahead. But I'm telling you, my friend, there's power coming from somewhere.
Well, you know, there's a good friend of mine did an experiment where he took, he didn't explain exactly what kind of coils he used, but he took to conductive copper wire and ran it from about a 1,000-foot elevation down to about a 500-foot elevation.
Yes.
And put coils in, and he actually picked up usable energy off of that simple system.
Absolutely.
You know, from apparently nowhere. Now, the energy is obviously being produced naturally by the Earth or by the sun or some interaction between all of that, and it's being able to be drawn off. I think that's really the essence of some of this, at least one version of a free energy device.
That's what Tesla was all after, right?
Right, that's right. And it's a case of sometimes, you know, these things happen purely by accident. You're trying for one thing and something quite different occurs, and that is probably what you're experiencing. I mean, 400 volts, that's a lot of
On my butt a few times, and I worried for my equipment. That was the number one thing, so I actually put a device in there that took all that voltage to ground. Granted, not a whole lot of current, but enough current, and it really hit me hard, shocked me a bunch of times before I finally learned that power is coming from somewhere. You might suspect from some coupling from power lines going by, that sort of thing, but we've got very relatively low power lines. A lot of them are underground here, and even the ones that are in the air are very low voltage comparatively, you know, very rural power lines.
Right.
Very unlikely that this kind of voltage would develop. So, and then I called the power company because I was so curious, Doctor, and I said, look, you guys have zillions of lines in the air. We have a local electric cooperative here, and you must have a bunch of long lines that are unterminated or not being used. I want to ask you, do you measure large voltages at the end of these lines? And the response was, well, no, because by code, any unused line has got to be terminated to ground. That's a regulation. So they know and routinely accept the fact that they get this incredible power on these lines that's coming from wherever.
Yeah.
And they just ground it. They don't want anything to do with it. They just sort of ignore it and ground it. So he had nothing to say on the subject other than that, oh, yeah, sure, we ground it.
Well, you know, when you have intense solar activity, it can actually send a charge through power lines.
Granted,
That can then blow out transformers. In fact, if you go back to the early Woodpecker signal from the former Soviet Union that we were talking about, you know, there was a power failure in Quebec around the time that was occurring.
Totally. I understand all that, but I'm telling you, Doctor, this is separate and apart from that.
Huh. It's interesting. I mean, I think this is, again, goes back to, you know, some of those things that, again, we're not clear on what the cause and effect relationships are, but think about that in the context of the kindergarten with the hand grenade, and that's the equivalent of our scientists. You know, we hope they don't pull the pin, but there's a lot of folks that are very excited about their area of science and are willing to take risks and take and expose the rest of us to those risks without much consideration. I think
here we go. So we know science is doing this, and we know that they're way out there somewhere, but how do you get oversight on a project that is, by its very nature, so secret it's probably violating treaties? How do you get oversight on something like that? Because the answer has to be, oh, we're not doing that.
Well, and that's been the standard story. They've gotten caught a few times along the way, so they've been a little bit less willing to talk to media because they've gotten caught in their own trap. The other thing that's happening now, and the effort that we put forward was predominantly to let European parliamentarians, our traditional allies, know what was happening here on this project. And as they got involved, the European Parliament did finally take an action. That was the beginning step. You know, after that, there was a major study done by STOA, which is a group within the European Parliament that does technical and scientific research for the Parliament. And they analyzed all the literature dealing with everything from the electromagnetic effects of toaster ovens all the way to these large weapon systems. And their conclusions were that there were significant risks. Now, since that study has been completed, I'm not sure how much progress they have made. Our guys that we worked most closely with in the European Parliament are no longer in that position where they can help us there. But we did see the resolution passed. The Russians acting recently, that group of Russian parliamentarians that acted actually heard one of my presentations in 1997 in Brussels when I was speaking to a group called GLOBE, which represents legislators from 40 countries dealing with primarily environmental issues. And at that conference, there were 12 members of the Russian Duma that heard my presentation, which was dealing with Arctic issues, and my section dealt with HAARP. That is what started their look at it, and what took so long was their scientists were reluctant to come forward. But once they came forward and explained how these technologies worked and the fact that they could work, that's when that resolution finally passed. Now, the effect of it, we have not seen much. I mean, we see it now starting to surface in some of the discussions around the world, so obviously people have taken notice in other legislatures or parliaments within Europe. And I think that's ultimately the only way that accountability will be forced
Okay,
on this project.
Back for a second to the tether. Now, the tether was a real scientific surprise. Now, I have not seen nor read any follow-up to the tether experiment. Obviously, science had to be so shocked, pardon the pun, with that result that you would think that there would be immediate proposals for experiments to find out what they really encountered when they let that thing loose, how much they really encountered, because certainly they couldn't measure it. They could make guesses, but they couldn't measure it. They couldn't know how sustained it was. It could be something very important for humanity as a power source. I mean, I'm sort of
sure.
Fishing around here, but in other words, where is the follow-up?
And again, you know, what often happens with many programs is a certain amount of the program is public because it's unavoidable. In that case, people could see it from the ground, right?
Yeah, well, sure.
So you had to have some plausible explanation for what you're doing. And maybe the intention was exactly that, was to draw energy off in a way that could be useful.
Well, in that case, they got a hell of a result. So where is the follow-up? Are they going to do another experiment? Did anybody ask NASA? Well, okay then. With regard to the tether, what next?
Well, and I think the nature of these things are, once something is discovered that is unexpected and might be useful, these things tend to go black. I mean, if a power supply were realized in the ionosphere, it would not be to the United States' advantage to announce that.
You mean black from an intelligence point of view?
From an intelligence perspective, yes. I'm sorry. But basically just taking it out of the public view. What if every country knew that there was this unlimited power supply available for space platforms? They would quit worrying about that particular technical aspect of space platforms, which is the most important aspect, incidentally. So it would make sense if they discovered that to just be totally quiet about its implications. And I think, though, anyone watching that with any science background would look at it and say, wait a minute, where did that energy come from? How much energy was there, and what can we do with it? Which is exactly what I believe our government is, in fact, doing. As we move forward to space-based platforms, think of this concept of preemptive warfare, the idea that you can wipe out your adversaries before you let them know that they're an adversary. This is a pretty interesting thought, because what if the Chinese make the breakthroughs first? Or what if the Russians go back and make breakthroughs in this area, or some other rogue state, as they're calling them now? Then who can really get to the technology the quickest is going to be the victor. That is a very dangerous thing. Speed of light weapons and preemptive war do not mix.
Well, Doctor, we can't let treaties get in the way of something that profoundly important to our very survival now, can we?
Well, unfortunately, you know, that's the mindset that too many people are taking. Then why bother with the treaties in the first place if we're not going to honor them? The fact of the matter is, we have to find some way to find some compatibility with our science, with the advancements and the risks the world takes. And it doesn't include excluding our traditional allies, which we have been doing. And we've been doing it since 1998 and 99, when we first started talking about this issue of the ABM treaty, as an example. And nobody, none of the parliamentarians in Europe could imagine the U.S. doing this without at least cluing them in.
All right. We're looking now, of course, from all of you out there, for questions that are relevant to what Dr. Begich has been discussing this morning, and we're about to go to the phones. But Dr. Begich, very quickly, well, actually a couple things. One is the sonars the Navy is using, is there any chance that these sonars are causing whales to commit suicide, beach themselves?
Absolutely. In fact, the Navy acknowledged it recently, and they actually settled a lawsuit. There's some holes in that settlement. The Navy actually looked at the beaching in the Bahamas. It was a multi-species beaching that occurred a couple years back. And on the beach where these whales came ashore was a scientist from Harvard University that was able to take the animals and actually have them analyzed at Harvard. And they determined that what had happened was a massive trauma. And the reason this happened is when sound travels in the air, for instance, 99.97% of the energy in that sound is bounced off or reflected away from tissue. In water, in salt water, it acts much differently. The sound, when it travels through salt water and strikes tissue, 100% of the energy is absorbed into that tissue until it hits a air cavity like lungs or nasal passages that exist in marine mammals. When the energy is released, it causes a massive hemorrhaging, which is what leads them to beach themselves. The same thing could happen to humans in the water where these sonars are actually.
So then you're telling me that the Navy in this lawsuit essentially acknowledged that what the sonar they used did that?
Yes. In fact, what they agreed to do in settling the case is they agreed to not use the sonars in any waters except in certain parts of Asia, which I think is interesting. And then the other area that they said that they would continue to use them is in wartime, and I kind of wonder what time it is now, because I keep hearing that we're in a war and that we're in the war zone as far as that goes. But the last thing that happened, the most recent thing that's happened, is if you look at the defense budget or the budget that came out of the House, and I don't know whether it stayed in the Senate. I've got to check it when I get an opportunity to do it, but they had put in an exemption to exempt the military from all environmental standards. The environmental laws that control what happens in private industry applies to military also at the present time. They want to get themselves exempted out of this. This has come up periodically, but apparently made it in the House version of the budget as a rider. If this happens, then the agreement that the Navy has just made with the litigants in California and Hawaii will essentially be moot. If they change the rules, then that lawsuit won't have any meaning whatsoever. And yet what's at risk is not just whales. It's all the life in the sea. In fact, we dedicated about 60 pages to this topic in our latest book, Earth Rising 2, which really gets into the meat of what's happening with the sonar. So it's not a dead issue. Just because this lawsuit is settled does not mean the story is over. In fact, we expect that this is going to be back to visit us in the not-too-distant future.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to let you do, was plug your book, and you sort of did that. But that's the latest, Earth Rising 2?
Earth Rising 2, the one that precedes it, is Earth Rising, the Revolution, and those are available through Earth Pulse and also on Amazon.com, which we're linked up to through you guys tonight. And you can also get them toll-free from us, and that's at 888-690-1277.
A couple of weeks ago, two weeks ago now, I was interviewing Bob Lazar. And Bob Lazar is sort of a guy who told about Area 51 and S4 and allegedly saw saucers and all that sort of thing. And I just asked him, I said, asking him was my downfall. I asked the audience, look, if there's more Bob Lazars out there, come forward, send me an email, call me, whatever. And I made the mistake then of asking Bob Lazar if he thought that it would be a good idea for people like himself to come forward and tell what they knew, and he said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But, I mean, there must be lots of people who know about experiments and science going on in the areas that we're talking about right now that do have information, and I guess you don't want them to come forward to you either.
Not necessarily. And, you know, what I had suggested to Tom Spencer, who was a chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the European Parliament, and it was to be his next initiative, was I had suggested a mechanism for a whistleblowing, to where you could come forward, but in an environment where, you know, where national secrets wouldn't necessarily be disclosed, but where people, either in the civilian sector or government sectors of the various countries of the world, had information that it was in our interest as the human race to have that information, which might actually violate some specific country's national code. But if the human race was at risk, that the human race had an opportunity to weigh in. So a whistleblower mechanism, I think, is still needed, but it needs to be done in a manner that is sensible, is rational, and I think that needs some thinking to develop.
But to get them to agree to some sort of amnesty here would be almost impossible. I suppose it could be pushed through and hopefully enforced, but...
Well, think about the what happened in. In fact, we use this as an example. What happened in South Africa after all of the horror? They did have an amnesty. You could come forward. You could acknowledge what happened. And if you didn't come forward and you got caught, you got your butt nailed. And I think those are the same kinds of things that could happen: is allow an opportunity for people to come forward in the public interest and make their statements in a way that does not jeopardize security, but at the same time...
That's tough. I mean, almost all of it is going to be under the blanket of national security, almost all of it.
But it's gotten too much. I mean, the fact of building this stuff, I agree. Building the equipment you don't want out there. But the concepts, the basic idea of say, ionospheric modification as an example, or triggering an earthquake as an example... Those basic concepts, those ought to be open for some discussion. The fact is, they are discussed periodically. If there's research going on that is violating an international treaty, there needs to be some way for someone to come forward and say, hey, wait a minute, this is fundamentally wrong. The countries that are doing this have agreed not to, and yet here they are playing this game. There needs to be a way to do this. I think we shouldn't have to wait until people hit their 80s and then we question their memories and everything else when they come forward, as we see in so many other controversial areas. People do want to clear their conscience, and there needs to be a manner and a mechanism to do that.
Well, you're right about people being in their 80s. I mean, by then, of course, your conscience goes to work on you. You don't have as much to lose, and so that's what we end up getting, people in their 80s. All right, let's try the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich in Alaska. Hello.
Thank you very much, Art Bell, and thank you, Dr. Begich, for your work. I commend your work, and I appreciate the credentials that go with it.
Where are you, sir?
I'm near Austin, Minnesota, but the radio signal's coming out of Mason City, Iowa.
All righty. Any question?
Yes. Regarding weather modification especially, and the upper atmosphere heating, is it not possible to lose... or remove atmospheric moisture, that is to say, blow it right out of our atmosphere, utilizing something like HARP?
Well, I mean, if you create that heating effect, obviously it's going to, whatever's in that space underneath it is going to move to fill that empty space. And so, in that sense, yeah, you know, it is removing moisture, but what happens when you shut it down? Eventually it comes back down and gets redistributed, but jet streams are what gets altered. And if you look at the weather maps and you look at what happens when jet streams do alter, dramatic changes in weather occur. You get lousy weather in the southeast, where you start to get snowfall where you shouldn't. You start
That's right.
to get freezing of crops and so on.
That's right.
And so these kinds of changes, when they occur, jet stream effects not only affect weather fronts, but they also affect the flow of moisture and cloud formations in terms of where they go and where they're going to end up in delivering that rain. So if the jet streams get altered and that moisture gets moved into another area where it's maybe not needed or is just unusual, like in the desert areas versus in the places where you're trying to grow crops, then you've got huge problems. When you have lots of countries experimenting in this way, you can get very unpredictable results. It's like the butterfly effect, where a small the flapping of the wings of a butterfly, was the analysis, can cause huge storms on the other side of the planet. And this was discovered when a scientist had made a very slight calculation error, but the ramifications of that error were huge. And this led into this whole area of chaos theory and the idea of small amounts of energy being able to create profound and unexpected results. And that's the essence of much of what we've been talking about tonight. Only the thing that's happening is they're not so unexpected anymore. Yeah. Now we're gaining an understanding on how to control them and make them happen at will.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Begich. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell. Hey, may I suggest a future guest and also pose a question to Dr. Begich?
Yes.
Pat Robertson.
Okay.
This is Blair in Sedona. Dr. Begich, my urge to impel you to run for political office is tempered by my skepticism of electronic voting technology in a democratic republic. Would you comment?
Well, you know, that is a really important issue. And, you know, I believe in paper ballots. I don't believe in there are some things that don't belong in terms of automation. And I think voting is the single biggest issue in the country. And
you,
I think
you made a public statement about this, haven't you? Voting machines, something about that?
Well, I just oppose them. I mean, I oppose them vigorously. I think that we need to stick to things that we can count at the end of the day. My brother just won the mayor of Anchorage here not too long ago, and he won by 18 votes.
18 votes.
And they used an AccuCount system, but fortunately there's also a ballot that goes with it, and they had to recount them. And in recounting them, the difference was one vote. So in this case, AccuVote was accurate, but only because there was a hard copy ballot that was behind it that could also be counted.
So let there be chads.
Well, you know, I think maybe we got to go back to ink, you know, so we don't have to worry about things hanging off. I mean, you're going to either put the X in the right box or it's not going to be there.
All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Begich. Hello.
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 Yes, thank you, Mr. Bell, for being there and making the world a heck of a lot better place to be in.
You're very welcome.
Esoterically speaking, I caught your message, and I think a few others did too. And when they steal works of art, bells, why, that's nothing more than the sheerest form of flattery. So whip it back on him.
And
two questions for your guest.
Yes.
Did you know that the state police of Alaska are paramilitary trained now? And two, did you know that Ted Stevens, he must be something up there with them, because Alaska got the lion's share, hands down, of all the pork that went into this latest spending bill.
Yeah,
a couple of good points there.
Yeah, you know, actually, it's not just Alaska, but most police forces around the country are moving in this direction. The Europeans actually are resisting it, calling the FBI corrupt in public reports and not accepting any of their recommendations in this regard. As far as, you know, sort of where it all goes, you know, militarization of police is a much different direction than policing generally has been in the past. As far as Stevens go, he is the chairman of appropriations. He is running the checkbook for the United States. And you are absolutely right. Per capita, Alaskans receive more federal dollars than anyone else in the country. And it is by virtue of the fact that Ted Stevens is there and controls that checkbook. And he's a very intimidating figure for people. I mean, people do not openly resist him for very long in the Senate, and you've seen that occasionally when his temper breaks out. He has made some public statements in Alaska regarding indigenous people in our state that is pretty backwards, talking about the indigenous population growing too fast and jeopardizing the present state of politics in Alaska. And those are statements that 10 years ago would have been considered totally unacceptable in the middle of the civil rights movement. And going today, you know, people objected very strongly, and the people that objected the strongest are out of their jobs. And the fact is, this guy and other people like him have tremendous power that they can wield, and they do wield it to benefit their state from their perspective. A lot of the pork that gets put into the program isn't even asked for by citizens within Alaska. It's just something he decides he wants to do, and he does it because he has the ability to do so.
Well, gee, maybe he could get together with a very famous person there in West Virginia and propose building a road between Anchorage and, I don't know, Charleston.
Well, you know, they're getting together on a lot of projects these days, and the thing about it is it's a lot of it is quite good. I mean, to be fair, I mean, there's a lot of things that that happen within the political matrix that get pretty upsetting to me. And I think a lot of it, in terms of military spending, the kinds of things that we're seeing happen now. You know, we're spending $87 billion to rebuild Iraq when we know by national reports that if we put that same money into the first peoples of this country, the indigenous, we could completely solve many of the big problems that have been plaguing indigenous people here for 200 years.
Well, that's a lot of money. I mean, I'd do a lot of things, $87 billion. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I very much respect and admire Nick Begich. I'm very grateful for what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Okay, I'm feeling a little nervous now because I know we're getting to the bottom of the hour, and I hope I have
sorry,
a chance
to. Just go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think the bottom line in all of this is life on the planet and, of course, the environment that supports life. And I think that it's just as important to be concerned about individual people who are being affected by this as the big picture. Both count. And I would really like to ask you what your opinion is as to what the Defense Department or its contractors are looking for when they are sending electromagnetic pulse radiation, supposedly, quote, non-lethal, unquote, weaponry, at unwitting guinea pigs, and what they are, testing them for. And in many cases, biochips have been planted in these people unbeknownst to them.
All right. Well, hold it right there. When they test, and I guess they... You know, there's a long history, which you alluded to earlier, Doctor, of the U.S. government spraying people in the Bay Area, of the U.S. government conducting biological experiments that will raise
right.
the hair on the back of your neck. So they've done this stuff, the nuclear things with the pregnant women, oh, God,
right.
it goes on and on. So if you extend that to imagine they're still doing it today, then they probably are exposing people to radiation of various sorts to find things out.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. In fact, probably the most difficult material that we ever researched was on the U.S. government's experimentation on our own citizenry. And Secretary of Energy O'Leary admitted to 500,000 Americans over 40 years being experimented on without their consent.
Mm-hmm.
And yet not one person ever went to court, and no one was ever put in jail for doing that. The same things in Nazi Germany caused people to swing by their necks at the end of the war.
How come there weren't, like, after she said that, like, big congressional investigative hearings into this sort of thing with some kind of result at the other end? You're right. I mean, she just came out and said it, and it
got...
No
one did a thing.
Everybody was shocked. It ran on the evening news. Everybody went, wow! And that was it.
And that was it. We never even got to find out who the 500,000 people were that they admit to, so they might be able to at least have some relief in their life. The fact is experimentation, I think, does go on. They try and get what they call informed consent, and every once in a while they get caught because they didn't inform people quite right. So this does go on, but the places where technologies get tested are in the battle environments. I mean, right now in Iraq, I'm sure that we're trying every technical technology that we have available to us in order to see how they work.
You know, if you can affect people's behavior, then here's a really good question for, kind of a politician. Dr. Begich, do you suppose that something like HAARP, if sufficiently developed, could be used to influence the outcome of a national election?
Great question. In fact, if you go back to a book called Between Two Ages, written by Zbigniew Brzezinski in the early 1970s when he was at Columbia University, before he became National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter. In that book, I think it's around page 55 or 56, you'll see a quote, which is a quote from J.F. Gordon MacDonald about electronically stroking the ionosphere to modify the behavior of people over large geographic areas.
Yes.
And then you'll see later in the text, because the whole text is about the technological implications and how they might be used. And what he says is that no matter who's in power, the temptation to utilize these technologies to further their political ends, whether conservative or liberal, would probably be used because of people's lack of good judgment. And essentially what he was saying was, that he really believed that as these technologies emerged, that politicians, if they could do it, would be tempted to try it. And if you remember, on a more overt basis, the last presidential election, you remember the word rats inserted into some advertising of Bush against Democrats?
I heard that. Yeah.
And it was a little bit of a subliminal, and he pulled the ad and everything. He said, oh, it wasn't subliminal. We weren't meaning anything by that. These are very powerful techniques. In fact, if you utilize even light sequencing, if you look, like when you're watching a television set in the dark, if you turn around and look at the white wall behind you, you can actually see the flicker rate, and usually it's incoherent. There's no real pattern there. But if people really understood, and there are people that do very much understand, that you can create a very highly suggestive state by having a flicker rate in the background of a broadcast, those things are not regulated by any law. And you can put someone in a highly suggestive state as they're watching that commercial and actually influence them in a much more profound way than a standard advertisement. There are no regulations, ladies and gentlemen, on this, and yet the technology has been well proven.
Okay, here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Good morning.
Good morning. It's so good to talk to you, Art, and also thank you very much for having Dr. Begich on. He's very knowledgeable, and
indeed,
these points that are being raised are points that need to be raised. I wish this were in the daytime where more people would be hearing it. Anyway, going back to the question of the tether. Oh, this is Joan calling from Cleveland.
Okay.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes.
And it's WTAM 1100.
You bet.
Anyway, there's an electric field that extends out from the Earth, as I'm sure Dr. Begich knows. Am I pronouncing the name right?
It's Begich, actually.
Begich.
Okay. Thank you. And it's about 150 volts per meter. So if you go far enough out, I don't know how long the tether was, but as it cut through, it would seem to me that that would be the source of the energy. Remember,
yeah,
you were talking about that a little
right.
earlier?
The ionosphere is fed from essentially the energy of the sun striking the magnetosphere, and the interaction of solar energy and the magnetic field lines create that energy that's there. And so the energy that's there is huge. I mean, it's well acknowledged that there's tremendous energy potentials available in the ionosphere. The problem has always been, at least, you know, this, well, not even a problem, just the question has been raised, can you tap it? And that was where HAARP began, with Senator Stevens again saying, hey, we've got this thing right out of Jules Verne.
Mm-hmm.
We can tap the energy of the Aurora Electrojet and fuel the planet. And at the same time, you've got, a few years later, a tether experiment where they're actually trying to tap that energy, and they get the surprise of their lives when they find out there's a heck of a lot more happening there than they even anticipated. And this is, again, why it's so important to not move too fast in these areas. Here they are having unexpected results almost every time they enter into these experiments. And if you don't have an expectation that is lining up with the experiment, you need to pull back a little bit and recognize that maybe we're missing a few chapters mm-hmm. of the book before we get to the final one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened. It's, again, you know, I don't criticize scientists for being enthusiastic about their fields, because everybody is. The question is exercising caution when the amount of impact we can have now has global implications, not just local implications.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question.
Yes.
Take care.
Bye now.
All right. You're very welcome. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Good morning.
I guess I'm the wild card dude.
That's you. You're the dude.
Okie dokie.
Where are you calling from, dude?
I'm calling from Houston, Texas.
All right, speak up good and loud like you're a Texan so we can
all
hear
righty.
You. That's it. Get right up on that phone and kiss it.
No problem.
That's the way to do it. All right, so what's up?
Well, your previous caller brings up all types of questions in my mind, but I'll stick to the main question I had for you guys, you and Mr. Begich. Good evening, gentlemen. And I've heard about this kind of thing in the past where people have seen, like, strobes in atmosphere on clear nights or light blasts.
Yes.
And I've seen this several times in the last 5 years. And I always reason it out and rationalize it out of my mind. You know, and these are on perfectly clear nights where there's hardly no clouds in the sky for many, many, many miles across Texas. I see these, like, almost like an ambient. You know, it's not like seeing a flash not like looking directly at a camera flash bulb, but it would be like you'd be seeing the ambient light cast from it, but it's really quick, really fast, just like a flash. And I can't explain it.
Well, maybe one explanation certainly might be that we are testing something, and I'm sure the wide open lands of Texas would be one possibility of a place to test such thing. I don't know. That's just a...
It's tough to put labels on some of this. You know, we can look at the record and we can say, okay, here's a patent that would give you that same visual effect, which is what we were mentioning quite a while ago in this program this evening. But again, to draw those clean conclusions, you can make the observations, but again, you've got to be a little slow to leap to conclusions about what you're seeing, because it could be lots of different explanations.
As a point of interest, a couple of days ago, there was a release that scientists just found out that aurora is occurring many hundreds of miles above the Earth's atmosphere. They were seeing this from the shuttle, and they're going, what the hell? And it turns out it's some kind of aurora that's occurring way beyond where we thought aurora could possibly occur.
Right.
Very interesting stuff. We don't understand an awful lot of the dynamics of the Earth's energy and how it interacts with the sun, do we?
Do you remember the sprites that they were seeing on the top of storm clouds?
Of course, yes, of course.
That reached up into the ionosphere?
Surprise, surprise, yes.
And again, another surprise, not calculated in any of the calculations to make the global model, and yet here we are running around with experiments that are exploiting instabilities, that are creating instabilities, without full knowledge of what we're doing. And I think this is where this has to be broader. It has to involve the international community. It cannot be done under the cloak of darkness for military applications. Too much is at stake. There are too many risks involved, and we can't allow one country, even if it is our own, to run in this direction without some oversight. I just think we're entering into a realm that we've been in for some time now that is headed down a path that we may not easily recapture.
The moment you begin to spotlight the subject in terms of having international controls, then you immediately advertise the fact that, baby, you're doing it, or you can do it, or you've done it, or something.
That's right. That's
so,
right.
So I don't know how you do one without, bringing the other to the surface. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Steve from Arkansas.
Yes, sir.
With you talking about HAARP and climate control, one thing that just shoots out in my mind is earlier this year we had our government butted heads with the French, and the French have had a really bad year, and it kind of culminated this August with a massive heat wave there,
right,
that resulted in, I think they last count, 15,000 dead in France.
Right.
Alone.
Right.
This just jumps out at me.
Well, I was just in Europe in late October and early November lecturing in Lucerne, and the question came up from folks in Europe, could it be that some of our experiments are creating these effects? And the answer is yes, it could be. Is another question. The fact is there are many governments that are playing the game of weather modification on some level. How these things chain react around the planet are unpredictable. And then when you add in what nature is already doing, it's the straw on the camel's back, as I've said many times before. And it could be us, it could be someone else, or it could be nature exercising its own changes. But the fact is these things are occurring. When you look at, some areas are warming up, some areas are cooling off. There's reasons for that mechanically, but the basic message is things are radically different. Look at the amount of intensity of these storms in just the beginning of this decade. Look at the 90s compared to the 80s and the 80s compared to the 70s.
Well, yeah, my comment earlier, Doctor, we're not supposed to notice these level of changes in our short little lives, but we are, and that's meaningful. It means something unnatural. Abnormal is going on. West of the Rockies, is that right?
That's absolutely right.
You're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Hello, this is Olin in Culver City.
Hey, Olin.
Listening on KLGO.
Yes, sir.
I heard that the sun reversed its magnetic field. I was wondering, do you think that is causing the Earth to reverse its magnetic field, which will let in the solar plasma wind to burn us at zero magnetosphere.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting. You know, the idea that the Earth reverses its poles periodically is pretty well known. What's maybe a little lesser known is that there's sort of intermediate shifts that occur where the pole changes its location dramatically. Now, the question is it fast or is it slow? And these happen in relatively short intervals. A gentleman by the name of Hapgood, who was a scientist in New England, actually brought this thing forward. And what he said was that 10, 12,000 years ago, the polar location was right at the bottom of Hudson Bay. Now, think about that relative to the ice sheet moving through the Midwest. It makes a lot more sense.
I have in front of me an Associated Press story, Dateline San Francisco. It says, report, colon, Earth's magnetic field fading.
Yep.
Slight chance of flipping magnetic poles.
Yep.
And that's, I've got the whole story here, and I'll hold it for the next couple of days for the audience. But, I mean, here they are beginning to consider this, Doctor.
Yep, and the polar vortices, which a report came out in an Alaskan story in the north, is actually slowing down. The circular motion is slowing down, which indicates, again, a dramatic change is about to take place. What is that change? And how fast is it? You know, there's this big controversy in sciences that say, oh, these cataclysms, you know, they're not cataclysms. They happen over thousands and thousands or millions of years. Well, the fact is polar shifts have happened at 10,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, 80,000 years ago. That's pretty recent.
And in that process of polar flip for the Earth, there is a period, is there not, where what he mentioned, the Earth's magnetic field, essentially for a period, goes to zero.
Right, and the question is, if it's gradual over time, we're in some serious trouble. If it's cataclysmic and rather rapid, the exposure is going to be limited, but it's going to have profound effects.
But if we had a 20-year zero-gravity period of time, that would be...
Sayonara, everyone.
Sayonara, yes, indeed. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Nick Begich. Hello.
Yes, New Orleans.
Yes, sir.
I'm an ex-Air Force intelligence officer.
Are you?
And you really need to talk to me, Art, because I was stationed at Bentwaters, and I know a lot about that Rendlesham deal.
Okay.
We need to have a long, private conversation on the phone sometime.
Why private?
Well, I have certain exposure legally.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, you see, we were just talking about that earlier. See, I'm not sure I want certain exposure legally, and it sounds like you're going to dump it on me.
Well, no, but they can harass you more than anything else.
Yes, they can.
Yeah, here's the point, though. There are three BMUs sites, which are ballistic missile early warning sites, in the world. One's located in Alaska.
Please.
No, this is not classified.
All right, thank you.
There are three of them. One's in Alaska. One's in Flyingsdales Moors, Scotland, and one is at Orford Ness, which backs up to Rendlesham Forest, which backs up to Bentwaters and Woodbridge.
All right.
These things are huge antennas, about 20 or 30 acres in an area and about 500 feet high because they're over the horizon radar. And they emit enormous amounts of energy. But guess what? And I found this out because I'm right next door to one when I was stationed over there.
Yeah.
When they built these things, all right, before they turned them on, guess what those acres and acres worth of cable did?
What?
Sucked in energy.
Oh.
Just like your antenna.
Oh.
That's how the Air Force got the idea for HAARP, because when they built the BMUs, the things would practically glow in the dark because they were sucking in so much energy.
Dr. Begich?
Well, I have not heard this before. So.
But it's logical, isn't it?
Yeah, it does make perfect sense. And again, When you're looking at these systems, you know, why did they locate HAARP in Alaska? They wanted to be close to where the magnetic field lines intersect the Earth, because it's easier to pump energy in, and maybe it's easier to draw energy off. You know, it's an interesting question.
Well, as you built to achieve one, you would likely notice the other, as he was pointing out.
Absolutely. So it's interesting. I'll watch in the literature to see what might appear in this area, because this does make good sense.
Okay, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Begich.
Hi, Art, and to your guest, too. This is Colin Green from Visalia, California.
Okay, well, I can't let you use your last name on the air.
I'm
so
sorry,
what's your first name?
Colin.
Colin is calling. Yes, okay, Colin.
And
rock
I'd like
and roll.
I'd like to say hi to my mom, too. She'd appreciate it.
Hey, Mom. All right, Colin, to
okay.
The question.
There's out here in Visalia area, My wife and I have over the past couple months and several other people have seen something like a shooting star going either northerly or westerly, and it's like a yellow or green colored, yellow and green colored light.
Oh, yes.
And it's about 500 feet wide, and it goes super fast. And I've called the UFO reporting place, but it's more like a testing thing. And, and there's been other people that have seen it, too.
All right. Does it come from a specific location?
When I seen it about 9:30 at night a couple of months ago, it was coming from east to west. And I guess from, like, southerly place. And I'm not sure if it's, like, from the Edwards Air Force Base down in Barstow area or
gotcha.
What.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you. So much of this is hard to know what to do with reports like that. But if, in fact, we are testing this sort of thing, then those kinds of reports would be...
Those are the kinds of things you'd be hearing about.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and again, it's a tough to put it all together, because when you're making observations without the full information, they're just observations. When you collect enough of them up and they start to fit a pattern, then you can start to analyze them in a different way and start to knock out what the possibilities are. Like in this case, the first thing I would look at is the timing, and I would look at satellite movement to see whether or not that might have been something that you were seeing. I would look at all of the possibilities that would be logical first and try and eliminate those and narrow it down. And then you might get to something a little bit closer to the facts, because oftentimes people jump to conclusions without eliminating those things, when many times it is exactly those things.
All right, Doctor, we're woefully out of time here. If they want to learn more about HAARP and about the energy weapons and things we've been talking about tonight, you've written a lot. What do you recommend they read first?
Angels Don't Play This HAARP is now in its 8th printing. It is the most detailed material on this project. It's also translated in a number of languages. Following that would be Earth Rising the Revolution, which has some updates of some significance on the HAARP system and on weather control. And those are available through us at 888-690-1277.
Do that again. Always give numbers at least twice. Are you ready, folks? Okay, go ahead, Doctor.
888-690-1277.